Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and reading with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
Welcome to a special Mother's Day edition of Nancy's Bookshelf. Later in the hour, I'll have a conversation with author Wick Humble and his mother, who is a volunteer at Butte County Library, and an avid listener to North State Public Radio. In a month, Ida Grace Armour will celebrate her 100th birthday. But first, her husband Wick Humble will tell us how to restore the popular Datsun Z car. My guest today got a BA and MA from Chico State University and taught preschool and kindergarten for 33 years. James Wickersham Humble was a U.S. Forest Service firefighter for 5 summers. He was a Mayflower Van Lines driver and now author. He's been interested in collectible cars, hot rods, and sports cars since he got his driver's license and first car in 1961. Wick Humble has worked on Packards and Studebakers, has restored 1955 and 57 Chevrolets, VW Bugs, and Datsun Z cars, both professionally and as a hobby. He has contributed articles to various automobile collector and restoration magazines and served as associate editor of a magazine devoted to Datsun Z cars. He wrote a book, which sells in many countries, including Japan, on how to restore your Datsun Z car. He photographed his personal car, which he bought new in 1970 when he got out of the Army. Wick Humble, welcome.
Thank you very much.
So the photograph that we see on the back cover of your book was your car.
Was my car, my original 1970 car.
Now, I don't know much about cars, but color, I can tell it's a green. Is that British racing green?
We laugh. We call it Japanese racing green.
Japanese racing green.
But it, when we checked the color on the color chips, it also turned out to be an exact match to a famous color called Mack truck green.
Oh. So did you take the photographs yourself for most part?
My younger brother was a Northern California manager for McCurry Stores and was quite a camera buff. So he took all the cover photos and he's done some for my articles too.
Because there are a lot of photographs in your book, which I view would be essential if you're trying to show somebody how to restore a car, that you need a lot of photographs.
I have to take the blame for most of those. And, of course, this was written in the 80s when it was all film cameras. And so you didn't know your mistakes until you got the film back from the processor, whereas now you can fix them as you go, which is good.
Well, you know what? The other day I was reading the Wall Street Journal. I saw this article, Travel Around the World in a Datsun 280ZX. And I thought, oh, good, because I'm going to be interviewing Wick about his Datsun Z car. And I didn't realize the difference. There is a difference in a 280Z and a 280ZX. That X is a big difference, I understand.
Yes, it is. As a matter of fact, there was a car that was produced starting in 1970, 1969 for a few of them actually, and went right on through. The Z and ZX versions both use the same basic engine, which is an engine that it's a lot like a Model A engine. You couldn't kill it if you dropped a Caterpillar tractor on it.
Well, in fact, that's what this article was about, a guy who had a Datsun 280ZX, and he traveled around the world with his Datsun. So it is a very reliable car, and it's a 1979.
79 was pretty early for that car, but it was the year before the 280 demise. And it is a good car. I have a friend here in town that flies a wonderful old biplane that can't be separated from his ZX. But if you were to choose, and this is just an inside tip, the only really good and valuable ones are the 70, 71, 72, and perhaps 73 and 74 because they're easy to work on. Mm-hmm. After that, they became fuel injected and were subject to a lot of extra safety regulations that didn't contribute much to their safety, and they really are kind of a drug on the market.
Well, I mentioned to a friend this article about the Datsun ZX car, and he was unimpressed because he likes the Z cars. He wasn't a fan of the ZX cars.
It is kind of partially because of the way automotive things were happening at that time, that safety and emissions had come in with both feet. And the early Z is just benefits from the fact that they weren't regulated quite as heavily. It's in actual fact, up to 1975 now, are not required to go through a smog check because there are so few parts available to put them back to stock again and make them work exactly right. So in any case, any car, 1975 and older in California, is liable for emissions control but is never checked for it anymore.
Well, I asked various people, knowing I was going to be interviewing you, if they were familiar with the Z car, and I was surprised how many people were. And so I asked them, well, what did you like about the Datsun Z cars? And so I'm going to ask you, tell us what you liked about it. What was the attraction when you were, when you got out of the Army and you decided, okay, I'm going to get a car, why did you select a Datsun Z car?
Well, it was my second choice, actually. I had been saving and saving for a Porsche. And my brother was in France going to school at the Sorbonne, and he was pricing Porsches tourist delivery for me right along. And they just kept going up in price. And the car magazine suddenly brought out pictures of the 240Z and said what a great bargain it was at $3,600, whereas the Porsche was $5,600.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, I could afford that and have a life too. And it was pretty. And as it turned out, you can't kill the cars. They'll run and run and run. And they're really accessible for a hot rodder or a person like myself who likes sports cars and hot rods to do their own work, which is one reason I wouldn't have chosen many, many cars to write a restoration book about, because there's simply no market for them. They're hard to restore and, you know, and let's face it, the Mustang books were all taken already.
Yes.
But this particular car is just a jewel. I get kidded a lot by my hot rod friends saying, well, I sure hope you got a big Corvette engine under the hood. And I said, Corvette engine's fine in its own place, but why should I replace the best part of the car? It's interesting to note that my wife, I was playing in a band and decided to come out of Chico for a while before we were married, and my wife-to-be took the car for the whole summer and really loved driving it around. I've noticed that for a couple of factors, ladies took to this car immediately. One of them is it's got a roof. Let's face it. They do
last. No convertibles.
Yeah, they didn't ever make a convertible, and the cars just last a lot longer if they have a roof. That's why convertibles are so expensive now. But the other thing is it's infinitely adjustable for driving positions. I had a friend that used it for a month who was a 240-pounder. My wife weighed 98 pounds, and they could both get comfortable in the car and found it to be fun to drive. My wife immediately went out and got a ticket with it, the only one she's ever gotten.
I remind people, my guest is Wick Humble. And he has written a book on how to restore your Datsun Z car, how to restore the 240Z, the 260Z, and the 280Z, suspension and brakes, driveline rebuilding, common rust repairs, body prep and painting, engine compartment detailing, and interior restoration, all that in his book. It's a rather big undertaking that you did. Now, people will be saying, okay, don't know. Okay, he's calling this a Datsun Z car, but I don't see any Datsuns driving around on the road anymore.
Well, Datsun is a name that the Nissan Motor Company used for a long time. It was originally actually coined as D-A-T-S-O-N, as in the son of Dot, and D-A-T were abbreviations for three of the founders of the company in the 1920s in Japan. So it was the son of D-A and T. But for some reason, they decided that was not appropriate, or they had moved heavily upscale with, you know, more luxury cars and things like that. So Nissan would be taking Chevrolet or Buick and saying, well, from now on, we're going to call them GM cars and drop the Buick or Chevrolet name, which would never happen, of course. But that's the whole thing about it. And so that's quite a cachet. You see somebody with a Datsun hat or T-shirt, you go, oh, you're old school. You know, give me five.
Well, you mentioned that originally it was D-A-T-S-O-N, and I used to have dachshunds, little dogs, and we would walk them back when Datsuns were being made. People would ask if those dogs were Datsuns, and it was all my husband could do to say, no, they're...
9-9.
So the Nissan company dropped the name Datsun. That was, what, about 1985? The last
somewhere in there, yeah.
Okay. So, and then... I mentioned that there, because on the cover of your book, that you tell how to restore a 240Z, a 260Z, and a 280Z. And I don't hear much about the 260. I hear more about the 240 or the 280.
The 260 was a one-year-only car. That was the 240 just reflects the fact that it has 2,400 cc's, or 150 cubic inches, which is small for an American car but big for an import. And the 260, they had found that the smog emissions type equipment added to it made it slower, so they just boosted the size of the engine to 2,600 and later to 2,800. The 2,800 cc cars, the 280s, had fuel injection and things like that, and are, you really need to take them to a specialist to get them fixed.
Mm-hmm. Well, my friend also mentioned, he explained what a 2+2 was. And he wasn't a fan of the Datsun 2+2 because he said he felt like it changed the profile, which he liked. Mm-hmm. He thought the original profile of the Datsun was very attractive. And so explain to people who, like me, might not understand that
term.
Sure.
Yeah. It's interesting because, I hang out with some Datsun people around here, and Steve Pedersen is my best friend. He found out about me from reading the credits in the front of the book where I thank people at Martin Autocolor, where I work, for some help they did with the paint. And he said, well, this guy must be local. But we tend to kind of look askance at the later ones. So they're quite usable cars, and they're pretty in the same way. The 2+2 was less so because they'd flatten the roof out. It's a really practical car in most senses.
Yeah, in fact, when I looked at the one with the two seats, I thought, well, where do you put – you don't have much room in that car, interior.
I actually considered buying one once when we had two little kids because I'd found a good deal on them. The thing was that Steve and I considered Datsun to have dropped the ball big time because one of their stylists had redone the car before the 2+2 came out as a cute station wagon. And it looks nice. It is a great-looking car. And they finally released some original drawings of it, which we framed and put in our offices. But it would have been a much better car and a huge seller, I think. But the 2+2 was just a heavier, slower, and a lot more prosaic Datsun, you know, and kind of led to what they eventually produced. The little green car that I had bought new that I restored for the book was a it was quite a family plaything. But when I wrote the book, a friend was going to have me restore a car for him. He owned a 2+2, and we'd driven it to Reno to the Harris old car meet. And he said, I think you're going to love it. And I said, I love it, but I don't love it as much as my early one. And he said, you know, what's the problem? And I said, well, it's, you know, it does ride well, but it's stodgier and things like that. So he was going to buy a two-passenger one and have me restore it so I'd have a car to do for the book and maybe earn a little money, or maybe we'd split the profit and sell it. And he bought a business and couldn't do it, so I had to restore my little car.
Well, now I would think if you had one, you would take such good care of it that yours wouldn't need restoring.
It did not. It had one little dent, but it just happened that way. It was an economics thing. It was odd that in the 90s I took the car and I frankly didn't enjoy it as much as after it was restored because we couldn't get it dirty because it would ruin the value. And then in the end, catch-22, we got involved in a legal proceeding. An attorney wanted the Z car basically to pay it off, and I ended up selling it. But I lucked out in a way because Nissan USA knew about me and sold my book for me out of their dealerships. And when they heard it was for sale, they came and bought it and put it in their museum. So I was one of the few people that ever sold his car back to the manufacturer.
Well, and then after that, they launched a program where they invited people to restore cars, and they would buy them.
That was their motivation. Somebody had leaked it to, I think it was Auto Week, one of the sports car newspapers that comes out every week, and they had nothing to show. And so first they came and borrowed my car for the Sacramento show, and were really nice to me to get the use of the car. They showed it with their race cars, the Paul Newman car and some of those, you know, that they had. And then they decided when it was for sale, they decided they needed it. And I didn't get the money out of it I wanted to. I paid about $3,600 for it, and I sold it for $12,000. The cars they restored, which were really nice jobs, and were resold with a full new car warranty, 12-month warranty, were very nice. And nobody knows for sure, I guess, what they went for, but I think they went to the dealer for about $25,000.
Well, explain how their restoration program, because I hadn't heard of an automaker doing such a thing.
I don't know if it's ever had a precedent. They had to canvass every single parts depot they had in the world and said, send us virtually all your old Datsun Z-Car parts. And they sent them all to a shop in L.A., a contract restoration shop. It was quite a big job for the guy. He probably had 50 cars sitting there for a while. And I think they were some in the neighborhood of 25 to 30 of them were finally done that way. And the dealers showed them, built up showroom traffic with them, and I think they all put them out to Barrett Jackson auctions and things like that. I haven't encountered any. I was kind of shocked. I was at Laguna Seca with the Pedersen brothers, and we ran into a famous Datsun racer, and he knew of my book, and he said, oh, I'll bet you're going to be mad Nissan sold your car. And I said, oh, they didn't even mention it to me. And he said, well, don't worry. They sold it to an extremely wealthy collector down in the L.A. area, down Hollywood area. And he said, I'm sure it's probably very happy. And I said, as long as no high school kid's driving the wheels off of it.
My guest is Wick Humble, and he has written a book on how to restore your Datsun Z car. And you also have written magazine articles. I mentioned that there's a there are clubs, Z-Car clubs, and there was a magazine devoted to the Z-Car. And when I opened to read your article, on the facing page was a list of winners, race car winners, and I knew that Paul Newman liked racing cars, but I did not know it was a Datsun Z-Car that he was driving.
Well, Paul actually was driving the later, most of the time, drove the later ZXs that were very distantly related to a production car. They were almost completely purely race cars, which is to say, more power to you, Paul, because they're harder to drive. But he actually drove himself to a national championship and earned everything. I mean, he would have made a name for himself without ever acting just by doing that amongst car people. But he's kind of a demigod to all of us now.
Yeah.
Doc Hudson, you know.
Yeah. Well, another thing, when I was looking at your magazine, I saw the name Steve Millen, and I understand he was a Nissan factory driver. And what does that entail?
Well, actually, that means the factory picks up all your bills and pays you to drive. And it's a wonderful place to be. They often employ more than one team, because most auto racing is a global affair nowadays. And Steve and a number of other people were a man named Bob Sharp and Pete Brock, and he was a guy that knew me, and a number of other really big name race drivers had some of which had already had quite a good name in racing, had switched to these cars back in the 70s and just won every class honor there was with them. Nothing stays permanent, you know. Things move along, and no matter who's the overdog today, there's somebody else who's going to knock you off later, and that pretty much happened. But they still make some incredible, crazy cars. I know that I think it was Road and Track magazine just rated the Nissan Nismo sports car one step below the best Ferrari in performance out of about 40 cars. So they're still they're players in the field still. But yeah, it's something to see. People collect these drivers' autographs from you. You have them autograph your glove box door or whatever you can. I have a great autograph from Mr. Katayama, who was there was a Nissan ad campaign run for a while where they had an old Japanese gentleman who would say love life and things like that, and that was an actor. But Mr. Katayama used to come to the United States in his 90s. And he would meet with us and hang out. So I gave him an autographed copy of my book, and he autographed a bunch of pictures for me. And then he took Steve and I and several other people out to do karaoke out to dinner. And I don't do karaoke much, but he liked it.
Well, now, you said something that surprised me, and seeing how all these cars you've restored, but you said you're really not that crazy about cars, per se.
Well, you know, I'm a car guy, but I'm also a teacher. And I don't think you can be a teacher without being a real person. And I don't think that's redundancy. But I'm real clear in my mind. I really like my cars. They're a hobby. But I love people. I love my family. And I love ethics and things like that. And I think that's where a teacher's head has to be. Otherwise, you shouldn't take a nickel of their money.
Well, and then your book is kind of, you're in the role of teacher. You're teaching people who want to restore a car how to do that.
That's true. And it comes fairly naturally to me. I can write these type of car articles in my sleep, literally, now. And I have an offer from a big magazine called Street Rodder. The fellow just emailed me yesterday and said, we liked your work and we want to have more ideas from you. So as a retirement job, I don't think I could beat it. Quite honestly, folks, it isn't much money, but you can write some trips off on your income tax. And as Mark Twain said, if it wasn't for the honor, I wouldn't go through with it.
My guest is Chico writer Wick Humble, and he has written a book on how to restore your Datsun Z-Car, and featured in the book is his own car, and I'm assuming that you and your brother, you said your brother took some of the photographs, started at the beginning and photographed the process along the way.
Yes, I did. Like I say, I used an old Nikon FTN, and I had a toolbox that I'd made kind of a tripod arm, it was only a monopod, and so I would swing my camera around and set it up with the flash and things like that and do what my brother told me to do, who was a professional. I'd bracket the f-stops and all that stuff, and some of them still are kind of sad, but you don't have to worry about that now with digital cameras. Steve Pedersen and I turned down a book last year called How to Hop Up Your Datsun Z-Car. For various personal reasons, we just didn't think we could get into it, plus the fellow wanted it done in 9 months. And I have to laugh because one of my favorite old TV shows is the old Bob Newhart show, or Newhart, the second show, where he's a how-to book writer. And I was writing this book at the time. And how much longer do you have to write this book, Bob? 2 weeks, you know? And I'm going to start another one and write it in 2 weeks. And I said, yeah, well, this one took me 3 years of spare time and hard work and my family putting up with a lot of complaining and noise and cost to get this car done.
So it took you 3 years to do the book. Therefore, it must have taken you about 3 years to restore the car.
It went on concurrently. Like you say, looking at the pictures, you can see I had a lot of comments on the internet. And one of them said, it's a good book, but why doesn't the fella get a haircut? And I thought, well, it's kind of a mullet. And that was pretty popular in 1985.
Well, you know what I noticed as I was looking at some of the photographs? I see a picture of you painting in a closed garage. And I think, oh, my gosh, Wick, what are you doing in a closed garage painting? And then I looked more closely and I saw that you have a special kind of tool. You wouldn't call it a tool. What do you call that?
It's what they call an air supply air mask, a respirator, and it actually used a separate air supply from outside the garage and things. I had the fans and things. This was so long ago that the paints that we used then are not even available anymore, basically. They're not current. I'm working at Martin Auto Color. I know about that. And I'm really not doing much of that type of thing anymore in any situation. If I need to paint something, I have a couple of friends that will rent me their proper spray booth with the fans and the lights and everything, and it's a pretty good bargain.
Yep. I would think that would be a lot of the expense. You were saying, well, it's an expensive hobby because you have to have special tools like this breather.
A lot of special tools, or you have to have access to people that have things like that that you can use. And the business right now, I mean, you know, getting in and restoring a car, I'm surprised my book sells as well as it does, which sells really pretty well and has for, you know, 24 and a half years now. That because the expense is so high, but there is a tremendous amount of interest, some good, some bad, on the tube in the living room that I don't watch anymore, and I read books, and it's.
I'm glad to hear that since I have a book show.
please read, you guys. Please, as a kindergarten and first grade teacher, I can tell you, but it's one of those things that. The admission ticket is extremely high. In the hobby, we say, you know, how many fun coupons can you write before you're out of money, you know? And it wouldn't be unusual for a paint and body job like I did on that car to cost you $10,000 today. Which, if I sold the car for $12,000 of Nissan, you can see there's no profit there.
My guest is Wick Humble, and he has written a book on how to restore a Datsun Z car. And if you were to do this book today, the photography would be much simpler.
Much.
A lot of things would be easier. So have you thought about doing an updated or a new edition?
Well, I'm hoping to have it done for the 25th anniversary of the book, and my publisher is on board with that, maybe a new cover. And I hate to say it, but the book really severely needs an updating and a revision.
And a new haircut?
A new haircut. I mean, I have to say, I'm not going to take a bunch of new pictures for it on the other end. I've just finished a 1971 Z, which is my replacement for this one, so I haven't really had one for 15 years. Actually, I built an old Mercedes sedan with a 280Z engine and transmission and drove that for 15 years and had a pretty good darn time with it, too. But, it's hopefully we will. I'm having a few technical difficulties with my revised manuscript right now. But the publisher's on board for it. And he said, yeah, why don't we do that? And he said, you know, we're going to be selling another printing. I think it's been 3 printings in 25 years. And I think the total printed number of books, I imagine people are interested to know this, is around about 15,000 copies. Which for a how-to book isn't bad, considering it's not a Mustang or Camaro.
Yeah, I was just going to say, because this is a very specialized group, your target reader.
It was only built for 3 or 4 years, the real valuable ones. The 280s, people do rebuild them, but probably not 1 in 20.
Well, for one thing, you aren't retired, so you'd have to, if you do a new book, do your spare, so-called time. But what about if somebody came to you and said, boy, Wick, I've got this great old vintage car that's rusted out, and it's such a great car. Would you please restore it for me? Would you take that on?
I usually don't because I'm not a business, and I have to be careful about that. And I kind of have made a My wife reminded me forcibly the other day that I had vowed I wouldn't work on anybody else's cars anymore except for family members, which I have several of those in my shop right now, and they're actually brothers and sisters and our children's cars and things like that. We're redoing a 51 Chevy that was my dad's for my son. He drove it to high school, and all these years later, he's approaching that magical age of 40, we're going to put it on the road again with all new parts. And my daughter has a 67 Chevy, too, that was also a car from our family.
Well, now, do you drive these around, Chico?
The 51 would be more like a cruise night car, but the little 67 Chevy, I'm driving it to work right now until this Datsun's finished. I have friends that say you're not going to drive that completely restored car because I've taken every nut and bolt out and refinished them. I said, my friends, I'm 70 years old. How much longer can I drive? I have to drive this car because the other car didn't pan out to be the joy I thought it would be, because to keep it show ready, I had to pamper it and keep it covered and never was driven in the rain and things like that, you know, never, because it was just too much trouble to clean up again to that quality. So,
well, I would imagine your publisher wants you to do another book. If you do another book, would you restore another Datsun?
It's an age thing for me right now. I really don't have the drive that I did, unfortunately. I wish I could say that I did, but I'll tell you, you're going to laugh and say, oh, no. Yes, I have written a great American novel also, and it's a lot more accessible for me and very little investment other than my wonderful joy of having reading all the time that allows me to write fiction. So I have a whole bunch of fiction and screenplays and things written, and I'm going to try to do something with them now that I'm retired. But poison is historical fiction, and I love writing it, and so probably that's my direction from here on out.
Because I was going to ask if your novels feature cars, but apparently if it's historical fiction.
Well, it incorporates from 1900 to World War II, and it incorporates many cars that I know, and I'm a real fan of airplanes. I'm a member of the staff out at the Chico Air Museum and take care of their T-33 jet trainer, which doesn't fly. No, I don't do that part of it, but I keep it polished. And it has a whole bunch of really well-researched, authentic stuff on that, but just woven in as an incidental. Americans like to read that stuff, and I notice the British do too. And the British publish a large proportion of all historical novels. And so, yes, it has some sympathetic British characters, no doubt about it.
Well, now, there's such a thing as a Z-Con. Mm-hmm. And do people from all over the world come to these? Or are these primarily Americans that come to the Z-Con? What that is.
It just depends on what your budget is. But yes, the the big conferences and conventions are tremendously good draws. I can't afford to go very often because it is an expense, and you know. But the international community, with the advent of the internet and things like that. Yeah, like everybody's else's back pocket, in a way of speaking. The parts exchange across borders now like nobody's business. And it's an interesting aspect of the restoration thing. One thing that keeps even the 70 through 78 Z cars going is that there's a pretty fair aftermarket of parts that are being created. And I'll tell you, mostly in Asia, not the Japanese part either. But you also build a hot rod, a 32 Ford or 55 Chevy, most of your parts are going to come out of Asia. You can actually right now build a complete 55 to 57 Chevy out of Asian sourced parts, all entirely brand new, running about $100,000.
Well, I was looking at the Z clubs. They're all over the world in foreign countries.
They are.
And I was surprised too that this Z-Con, this conference, has been held since 1988. That surprised me.
That particular one, yes.
Every year since 1988.
Mm-hmm. And since 1971, they've been having regional and national meets. And there used to be a Z Club of America, which finally faded, kind of like our Z Car magazine faded. Unfortunately, they both faded before things got really hot.
Well, I know fans of this of Z Cars. There are a lot more of them out there than I ever imagined. So it's been such a pleasure talking to you, Wick, about your book.
Well, thank you for inviting me here. And it's been I'm glad I'm able to say we can almost celebrate the 25th anniversary of the book in print, because it took a long time to came out back in the day.
My guest has been Wick Humble and his book, How to Restore Your Datsun Z Car. We're going to take a short break. And when we come back, Wick's mother, Ida Grace Armour, will join us. You're listening to a special Mother's Day edition of Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to a special Mother's Day edition of Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. Ida Grace Armour is a former school teacher who volunteers at the Butte County Library. She is an avid listener to North State Public Radio and will be 100 years old on her next birthday. Ida Grace Armour, welcome.
Thank you.
And I've also invited one of her sons, Wick Humble, to come in and join us. He's also a former school teacher and author. He wrote a book about how to restore your Datsun Z car. Welcome, Wick Humble.
Thank you very much.
I also understand you were in a band, Wick?
Well, my brothers and I had a band. We all played instruments in the marching bands, but we got into when, you know, rock and roll got to be hot because we're that old, and we formed a band. And it turned out to be pretty much almost a Beatles performance band because my two brothers were so in love with the Beatles. So it was a lot of fun. It was the original garage band. We actually practiced in a garage.
Well, now, was this before, were you still living in your mother's earshot at that time?
Well, I was at junior college in Reading, and my two brothers were in high school, so they were kind of allowed me to be on board. They didn't need a trombone player. That was my specialty.
Trombone.
Noble instrument, though it is.
Well, I wanted to talk to your mother. For one thing, you must value books, Mrs. Armour, because you volunteer at the library here in Chico. How many years have you been doing that?
Oh, ever since I volunteered in Alturas at that library, and I did just all kinds of things, whatever was necessary. I didn't much like to repair them because they put me in the back room all by myself. But
nobody to talk to in the back room.
That's right. Nobody to see. But down here at Butte County Library, I get to clean the exterior of books. And I take a big bag of towels and scrub sponges, and I have a squirt bottle, and I go to work on them. And I sometimes spend an hour and a half or 2 hours once a week.
One of the library crew told me when they found out I was our son, they said, oh, I remember Ida Grace. She came in the first time and said, I'm here for the dirty books.
Oh, now that's a good one. Mrs. Armour here for the dirty books at the library. Well, you mentioned that you lived in Alturas. Were you teaching school when you were in Alturas?
When I became a widow with three sons, I went back to school teaching. However, I wasn't qualified according to California credentials, and so they hired me with if I would finish my degree. And so I spent the winters teaching and the summers coming to Chico
to get your teaching credential for California. Yeah. Well, how old were you when you first began teaching?
18.
18 years old.
I took a course my junior and senior years in high school called normal training, which was supposed to prepare you to teach school. And then at the end of my senior year, I had to take about an examination over 13 subjects to pass to get a credential.
And where were you living at this time?
In a little village in Kansas.
So in Kansas, that's where you grew up? In Kansas?
Yes, ma'am.
So you took a course so that you could be qualified to teach school. What age students did you have?
From 6 to 15.
So that's quite a wide age range. How did you teach that wide a range of students?
I guess I just did what my school teachers had done. And I had some very good teachers in Kansas in a graded school. And we had music every day for at least a half hour. Wonderful music course. But anyway, I didn't have kindergarten, but I had first through the eighth grade. And that meant I had probably six-year-olds to 13 or 14 or 15.
Well, is this the classic one-room schoolhouse?
It's a classic one-room schoolhouse. I swept the floor. I made the fires. I earned my board and keep. What else did I do? Whatever's necessary is what I did. I could have hired the children, but on $40 a month.
You didn't have a lot of spare change.
And it was an only 8-month school because they had This was from the ancient days when boys used to be turned loose in the spring to help with the farming.
Mm-hmm. So on $40 a month, that was your salary, $40 a month, and just for 8 months of the year, what did you do when you weren't earning your $40 a month?
I was going to college to find a husband.
Oh, to find out. Your son is shaking his head, Mom.
I wasn't going to fall for any of those guys in my hometown. I wanted a smart man to be the father of my children.
Well, where did you go to look?
I went to the nearest college, which was a state teacher's college at Pittsburgh, without an H, Kansas. And I spent my $40 a month on room and board during the summer months. And I also lived with my grandmother, and my uncle, who was a banker, lived there, and he paid a fifth of his salary for rent. So I insisted on paying my fifth. So that took $8.
Well,
but college was cheap then. You could get a room up in the attic, usually, at a house for about $7 a month. Anyway, I went to college. I went to college several years before I found that man, though.
Well, is he the reason then you left Kansas?
Well, I guess it was because I married him. And by that time I had two children, was expecting another son. And that's why we left Kansas to better our condition, our situation financially.
And where did you go after you left Kansas?
Came out to Alturas, Modoc County, because there was a job there. It wasn't the kind that my husband was qualified to do, but it was a step towards getting better wages and better climate.
My guest is Ida Grace Armour, and she is 99 years old, and she is telling us what it was like when she was a school teacher quite a few years ago. I've also invited her son, Wick Humble, who is an author himself and a former school teacher, to join us here in the studio. Well, when you came to Alturas, how old were you? Do you remember?
No, but I was a married woman. See, I didn't get married till I was about 25, I think.
Which was unusual for that time.
Which was unusual for that time, because all my girlfriends were married. That was the aim in those days, because you could hardly get a job other than rural school teacher or...
Probably nurse, maybe?
As a nurse. I remember them saying that. I didn't want to be a nurse. And so I taught in Kansas for 7 years before I found that wonderful man.
So the two of you moved to Alturas, and then at some point World War II came along. And the reason I'm curious about your experiences in World War II is that when I was growing up, it didn't really occur to me to ask my parents questions that they could have told me about history. And I thought, gosh, what an opportunity I missed, because it didn't occur to me to ask him about those times. So now I have an opportunity to ask you.
This was a great experience. When we had only been married, we got married in May, and he got drafted at 29. And so I had already signed up to teach in my hometown, 5th and 6th grade. And he called up and said, I have a place for you in Camp Pickett, Virginia. I immediately gave up my job, and from then on, I followed Mr. Humble from one place to another. And that's an interesting story, because we lived in Camp Pickett for a while. I got poison ivy there. And then we found out that we're going to move to Florida. So I hurriedly got on a train, I think, and went to Florida, northern Florida, to Camp Blanding, and found a room before all the rest of the wives found rooms. And he was at Camp Blanding, and at that time he was a secretary to a brigadier general. So he got home on weekends, and we rented a room in a home there, along with other wives, for $10 a week. And we ate at the USO a lot because we weren't supposed to cook in our rooms. And we were there 9 months, I believe. And I put in for teaching, a substitute teacher, but I didn't really want to do it.
Did they call you?
Yes. I got to teach in a high school where the boys and girls were segregated. The boys had one stairway and the girls had another. One day I was in there.
You mean even separate stairways?
Yes. And one day I was in there and the fire whistle blew and half my class got up and left. Boys.
Oh, because they had to help fight the fire.
They were the firefighters. Okay, we found out that we found out that 79th was going overseas. He was in the 79th, and it was a cross.
Your husband, that is, now.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And he didn't get sent. And so we found out he was going to be moved someplace for on maneuvers. So I had a chance to ride home with somebody that was going to Wichita, Kansas from Florida. I went back to Kansas. He got sent to Tennessee. And he found a place for me to live in Tennessee, called up. So I went to Tennessee. And he got home on weekends. The Blues were fighting the Reds out in the woods someplace. And then this general said, you need to go to OCS. He said, no.
OCS meaning Officer Candidate School.
I'm not going to be an officer. He was a staff sergeant, as it was, which is fair. And general said, you're going to do something different, so I'm going to send you to college there and have you tested to see what your abilities are outstanding in. So we went to Alabama. We were there a while, and I found a room and a house. He was building someplace else. And the couple that I lived with said I was the only Republican in town. That's my only.
Well, Dad said there were only Republicans in Kansas at that time. So,
this is Mrs. Armour's son. Ida Grace Armour has a son, Wick Humboldt. I've invited him to join us in the studio. So he's listening intently to what his mother is saying.
So Jim got sent to Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to learn Greek, modern Greek. So I traveled up there and found a place to live and got a job in the University of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is 42 stories high, the administration building is. And I was on the 18th floor, but he was on the 10th and 11th. But we didn't. And so the Greek people were very nice to us and invited us to their homes, Thanksgiving and various times.
So now your husband was learning Greek from actual Greek citizens here in the United States.
Lots of Greeks up there. Yes.
And this is during World War II?
They were going to Greece.
It was a plan of Churchill's throughout the war to invade through Europe's soft underbelly. And the British eventually did go in after the war and got in trouble.
Thank you.
But Roosevelt and our generals did never see that as good. Plus, they had another war on their hands in the Pacific. So
this is why there were Greek citizens in Pennsylvania teaching your husband Greek.
There was all kinds of citizens in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Down at the base of that big building were rooms. Each nationality had furnished a room, which was typical. Wonderful place to work. Wonderful place to work.
Sounds like a language immersion program to me.
Mm-hmm. My guest is Ida Grace Armour and her son, Wick Humble. And Mrs. Armour was married to her first husband, whose last name was Humble, during World War II. And she's telling us what the two of them did during World War II, that her husband was not interested in going to officer candidate school, but he had an aptitude apparently for learning Greek. And so off they went to Pennsylvania to learn Greek.
Well, I found Dad's IQ papers from the Army, and apparently, contrary to convention, he had an IQ of 151, and they didn't make him a potato peeler.
Well, that says something for the powers that be in that time that they...
It's pretty surprising.
Yeah.
Well, the joke was if Superman had been drafted, they would have found out he could type 300 words a minute and he'd have been a clerk.
So you were in Pennsylvania for a while, and what did they do with this skill once he acquired speaking knowledge of Greek? Wick's shaking his head.
Well, they decided not to invade Greece, but we still had Japan to deal with. So he was in the Army Specialist Training Program, along with almost all the pilot cadets and things like that in the United States. And basically, they handed them all rifles and said, you're going to the Pacific. It closed down in 1 week.
So on short notice, he's gone to all this trouble to learn Greek, and they say, no, we're not invading through Greece, so off we're sending you to the Pacific.
Mm-hmm. You're back in the infantry.
So we were sent then over to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and I can't think of the name of that fort there. And that was a deportation place, and so I expected him to get sent overseas. Didn't do it.
And they didn't.
Didn't do it. And so we were there, 6 weeks or so, while they were deciding what to do with.
So you hardly knew from one day to the next where you were going to be living and what your husband was going to be doing and what assignment he would get?
On a shoestring.
And meanwhile, you have two children. This was before you had the children. Okay, so that made it a little less complicated.
So
this is earlier in your marriage.
We were sent back to crew. We were sent back to Camp Pickett. Jim was sent back to Camp Pickett, and I got a job at the guest house there as a junior hostess, and I was supposed to be nice to people. And when the hostess couldn't be, she was an older woman. I was young. And one day they said, "Your job today, we're going to have the bedrooms repainted. And there's 6 German prisoners that you're supposed to oversee. 6 POWs.
That you as an Army wife, was put in charge of these 6 German POWs. So how did you?
We learned how to talk to each other. They couldn't speak English. I couldn't speak German. They got to liking me. I followed them from bedroom to bedroom, seeing that they kept painting.
That was their job, was to paint, and your job was to keep them on task.
And we kept conversing until we were able to understand each other. And so I got a kidney infection, had to go to the hospital. And one of them drew a picture of Loretta Young for me with pencil. That's as a gift.
Do you still have that picture?
I have it.
Nodding his head.
And the funny thing is, when I was a young boy, I thought there was a picture of her.
Oh, you thought it was your mother he had sketched.
Uh-huh. No, it's obvious.
It is now, but when you're 6, it isn't.
Oh, you're 6 years old, and you see this picture of Loretta Young. You say, Mom.
And another one made me a wooden picture frame. A beautiful one with insets of wood, and I don't know what happened to it. So they liked me, and they didn't want to be fighting. Yeah. They wanted to be home, so they weren't in any danger, you know.
Yeah.
They were happy. They were getting 3 meals a day, painting the walls, and talking to me.
And they were probably motivated to learn some English, so they probably appreciated the opportunity for you to maybe teach them a little English.
I wish I'd kept a journal then. I didn't. So he was there a while, and I don't remember what he was doing there. But then
Your husband?
Yes.
I might mention, you referred to him as Jim. And Wick, were you named for your dad?
Yeah, James. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
Wick is your...
That's my grandmother's maiden name.
Wickersham.
Yeah, that's quite a prominent family.
Mm-hmm. So your name is James Wickersham Humble, mm-hmm. Named for your dad. And yes?
And in Kansas, I was known as Jimmy Wick.
So we were there a while, and I don't—
There, meaning in Virginia, where you were in charge
Camp Pickett, again. That was the second
making
time.
Making sure that these German POWs stuck to their painting job.
And isn't it strange that we got to liking each other?
Well, you know, you hear stories about that in World War II, that you're looking across the line at these men you're shooting at, and you really have nothing against these people. They're like you.
Then we got sent to Fort Bragg at Fayetteville, North Carolina.
You and your husband. Now, you leave behind the German POWs, and you and your husband go off to his next assignment.
And he was in the Signal Corps there. And it's a big, we were there quite a while. And I got a room with a nice couple. he was a lawyer, and they had some nice daughters, and I guess we were there about 9 months. So all in all, then Jim got sent overseas from there.
He finally did go overseas.
Uh-huh. And I got sent back to Kansas because we decided, I was 29 by then, I think. See, that was several years. I decided, yes, I did want to have a child. If he got killed, he got killed, you know. But I decided I wanted to. And so by that time I was pregnant, and I went back to Kansas.
Because you still had family there. You still had family in Kansas.
Yes, I did. And so I stayed there until he came back. And Wick was about 4 months old and still had the colic. And Jim said when he came back, he said, I know we had a list of names, the girls' names and boys' names. You didn't know then what you're going to. It's going to be, but I don't remember Wickersham was on it.
Oh, but that was your idea, because that was your family name.
My sister was to blame for that. She said, there isn't going to be any Wickersham descendants.
That's right, because you married and you took your husband's name, and your sister said, gosh, we need some Wickershams in the family.
It was all right with Jim. He didn't care. Anyway.
My guest is Ida Grace Armour. She lives in Chico now and volunteers at the Butte County Library. She will be 100 years old her next birthday and is telling us about her experiences growing up and specifically during World War II and her experiences as a school teacher.
From then on, it was just regular life. He got his job. He got his job back that he'd had before he went to the Army. And we lived in Kansas for a while, and then this friend...
What was his job, Mom? You didn't mention.
Well, his job was... he had taught in college and high school both, English teacher.
So he was he was a teacher, too, so you both...
Dramatic. And he had this friend that got out there, Modoc County, and she knew we wanted to get out of Kansas, and so that's how we got up there.
Because of a friend, the connection with a friend.
We didn't ever expect to stay in Modoc County.
She just looked over at her son.
That's
Wick.
Just the way it goes. It worked out okay.
Well, Dad kind of had his eye on a college teaching post, and he was thinking Chico, you know, at the time. I remember he said he'd sure like to retire in Ashland because of the Shakespeare up there. He'd been out looking at houses.
Been a teacher, having a
He wound up being curriculum director in Modoc County before he passed away. So he oversaw all the curriculum adoptions and things like that. And Ed wrote a lot of local history books, too. He organized a group of local people to write local history books about Modoc County, which I still have a set of, and they're very good.
So your dad didn't make it out of Modoc County then before he died?
No, he didn't.
Mm-hmm. So he...
He had passed away of a heart attack in January of 58.
It was when they weren't doing bypasses or anything like that. We went to San Francisco to the very best doctors that were down there. And they said, go home and eat a low-fat diet. So we all ate a low-fat diet. But it wasn't...
But that was all they had to offer at that time.
But he'd had... What had he had as a child? Something that had injured his heart. It's a wonder he ever got in the Army.
He was in the Battle of Okinawa and started smoking then, too.
You see pictures of World War II soldiers.
It was quite an ordeal.
Yeah, that they all were smokers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so your dad had a heart condition before he had a heart attack. So
he had a heart condition, I think, before he went in the Army, probably. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it was sad. Three little boys.
So there you are, living in
Modoc County.
Modoc County in Alturas with three young boys, and that's when you have to go back to... Now, you had a daughter later on.
We had... Well, that's another story. She remarried. She remarried later.
Yes, yes.
How much time? anyway, yes. But I got a job right away because he was so popular up there.
Meaning your husband?
Yes, he was called a curriculum director, wasn't he? He traveled all over the county.
Assistant superintendent, basically.
Visiting all these little schools that were lumber camps, you know, trying to make better teachers out of them.
Well, it was quite a boom in lumber and employment up there in the early 50s, and they opened any number of one-room schools again. And he used to take me with him once in a while when I had a day off from first grade, and we'd go out and see him drive through the deep snow to these little places out in the middle of nowhere, you know, Tionesta and Delmorma and all these tiny little buildings, old Grange halls they rehabilitated, and put a teacher in them, and it was back to that same mode. He had started in the first one-room school also in Kansas.
This is my guest, Wick Humble, and he is a former school teacher, author, and the son of Ida Grace Armour, who'll be 100 years old her next birthday. She's an avid listener to North State Public Radio, and I think you told me that the first thing you do in the morning when you get up, you turn on North State Public Radio.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Do you read many books? Because if you work at the library, you must appreciate books.
Right now I'm reading Democracy in America by Tocqueville. I've always wanted to read that because he
is referenced so often.
Well, he portend what's going to happen in the United States.
Isn't that amazing?
But it's awful hard to read. It's about that thick.
A really thick book, yeah. Wick, you're nodding. Have you ever read that book?
No, and I'm not going to either. I have her tell me what's in it. She loves biographies and autobiographies, and she's read the biographies of every president and world leader and their wives.
And I keep track of them.
You brought a notebook with you, and I see you in small writing. You have a lot of notes there.
Well, I have an index here of all the authors and what they wrote, and a little blurb.
The authors that you have read.
Yes.
And you make yourself notes so you can look back and see what you thought was important in the books you read.
There might be a quiz.
Oh, she might give herself a quiz afterwards, yeah. Or she might give you a quiz.
I've written up an awful lot of little incidents in my childhood for my children, and I don't know what'll become of them, but I have
well,
an idea.
Well, maybe you'll write a book yourself. Wick's written a book. I'm sure he'd be happy for you to write a book.
There's so many old folks that are writing these things, and I don't think that, you know,
You don't think you have anything to add?
Possibly. Well, a little different, maybe.
It's a really good thing. I mean, as a teacher, I went to two workshops in the same year, one on writing about our personal lives for the purpose of being better writers and explanation. And my wife, being a marriage and family therapist, I went tagged along to a convention with her, and that's what it was about. So they asked if I could audit it. Fits together perfectly. You should.
So that's your next book, Wick.
I've done it already.
Oh, all right. I want to see it in print.
Kiss and tell.
It's been such a pleasure talking to the two of you. And like I say, I would love for you to write your book. My guest has been Ida Grace Armour. She will be 100 years old her next birthday. She is a volunteer at the Butte County Library, a former school teacher, and an avid listener to North State Public Radio. And I invited her son, Wick Humble, to join us today. Thank you, Wick.
Thank you.
You can hear this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.